Climate is never static and changes repeatedly, often in inconspicuous ways. That is just one observation from a pair of archaeologists who we have the pleasure of spending the hour with on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So they've constructed a historical telescope of sorts. We get to peer inside at the past tens of thousands of years to find out how human society has adapted and transformed in the face of, you name it, climate disaster, you fill in the blank, and of course, what it all means for today. So what questions do you have about ancient civilizations, how they crumbled? What role do you think that climate change played in their downfall? It's 800-642-1234. The book is called Climate Chaos, Lessons on Survival from Our Ancestors. Co-author Brian Fagan is here, Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Brian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Oh, good morning. We also have co-author Nadia Durrani, who is an archaeologist and editor and founder of Past Worlds magazine. Nadia, welcome to you.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Hello. Let's start with you, Nadia. Meaty question, elephant in the room. Climate change is often presented as this cataclysmic event that could spell the end to humans on Earth. Do you think that humans can survive catastrophic climate change that's caused by us, that's anthropogenic?
I think ultimately we can survive, but life will not be as we knew it. If we look back as archaeologists, as Brian and I have over the last 30,000 years, we see the impact of changing climate on so many different cultures and civilizations, and we see what happens. And change is inevitable, and we need to change. So while we will survive at some level, we need to change, and we need to adapt as well.
Brian, do you concur there?
I would agree with her. One of the points is that planning for adapting to climate change is not invariably an immediate decision. It involves long-term planning. A lot of our planning is for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and further out. And politically, this is suicide because people always think from one election to the next, which is stupid because the issues we face now as humanity, and we're not just facing them as Americans or as British or as French, it's us as humanity that are looking at problems which are going to really come home to roost in a century, a half century, or much longer. This is a focus for long-term planning that is very hard to handle politically.
Sounds like we could learn a few things from those short-sighted emperors in the Roman Empire that didn't think beyond their lifespan.
Oh, yes. That's a great deal we could learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And when we do look back over all the thousands of years, we do see that things that people did in the past aren't always accessible to us these days. For example, throughout time, often different peoples would disperse, would move, things would happen that we can't necessarily do. But yes, we do need this kind of long-term planning, as Brian says.
Well, let me reintroduce you. We have archaeologists Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan co-wrote the book Climate Chaos. We're going through civilizations thousands of years to look for answers to the toughest climate questions that we face today. You can join in 800-642-1234. Brian, I was absolutely fascinated by the rich detail you have on these ancient civilizations and what archaeologists can glean through all of these years of research on 70,000 years, 300,000 years, 30,000 years. How are you able to determine when there were droughts and when there was extreme cold or how many people lived in a certain place?
It's fascinating to have lived through a revolution in the ways in which we study ancient climate and ancient societies in the context of climate. There has been, since the El Niños in the 90s, a revolution in paleoclimatology, the study of ancient climate, because they have developed much more fine-grained ways of looking at, say, drought or rainfall by using growth patterns in stalactites in clay, in caves, by refining tree ring analysis. Now in Europe, for example, we know pretty well what the climate was like by the season for the last 2,000 years. Mm. And things like that, we are getting much more sophisticated by the use of what are often called proxies, which are indirect indications of climate change. At the same time, archaeology has embraced high-tech science and now is really involved with biological anthropology at all kinds of minor details. A century and a half ago, you could go out and find an ancient civilization in a week. Today, we move less earth than people did in 6 months. We really are much more fine-grained, and a great deal of work happens in the laboratory.
Yeah, in the labs. You know, Nadia, how can you make these population estimates and have a really good sense of how many people were living in a place at a certain time?
That is a really difficult question. So we estimate that around 5,000 BC, there were probably around 5 million people. We estimate around the time of Christ, about 150 million. And then by 1800, we know it's kind of a billion people. How do we get to those figures before about the year 1800? It is very, very hard. When we're looking right back in time, let's say 5,000 BC, we're really looking at settlement patterns. So again, archaeologists look across landscapes. So they try and work out the density of populations, for example, by looking at the settlements, how many people might have been living here and there versus how many people in the countryside, quote. So it's very, very rough, the estimates, when you go way back in time. But you did have these massive cities at certain points in time. So, you know, there were about a million people in, you know, living in the Roman Empire and so on. So we do know, you know, we do have these broad estimations, but it is hard going way back into time.
Well, before we get to the Roman Empire, Brian, I am on Team Indus all the way. Indus civilization, they had shower cubicles. They had sanitation comparable to modern era. They had plumb toilets. What were they doing?
You know something? The real expert on this is Nadia rather than me.
Nadia.
Yeah, let me just make one comment. This is in considerable reason due to the fact that much of the civilization was very rural and kept the flexibility of rural villages. So now I'm going to pass the tennis ball to my dear colleague because she's much better at this one than I am.
Well, Brian's dead right. There were people in the sort of rural areas living out their lives. But as you say, there were also these amazing cities with really developed sanitation, toilets, right? 2,000 years before Rome and so on. So oldest toilets in the world. This was a really advanced people. And they did have a network. They worked the monsoons. They knew what they were doing. They were very advanced. They were very widely connected. So we know they traded with Arabia. You know, these were a really sort of advanced civilization. Interestingly, there's very little sign of social differentiation in the cities. So people were quite kind of egalitarian, quite equal in the cities, at least. So all the houses look much the same. You know, there aren't these grand palaces and humble abodes. Everybody's living quite a good standard of life in the Indus Valley cities. So we have these very advanced cities in the Indus, yes. And then suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but certainly by about 1300, they're up there and then they're no longer around. You know, what happened? And we think now that climate had a big role to play in the end of the Indus.
Was it drought? What was it?
we do know that there were drought episodes, and we think that people, there were salination problems in the cities, there were issues with the rivers drying up, so there were problems which people are still trying to come to terms with. Don't forget that the Indus Valley, even though it was this amazing civilization, we've only actually studied it for the past 100 years, and people are still trying to understand what was going on. Because it's in modern day Pakistan and India, we haven't studied it quite as much as, let's say, Rome and so on. So the answers are still not fully known. Tantalizing questions remain. Amazing civilization, what happened? We do know climate change had a role.
Archaeologists Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan explaining how environmental knowledge has passed down through generations, how our ancestors reacted in the face of climate change through the ages. You can join in. Are you worried about a spike in the number of climate refugees due to flooding and wildfires? What elements of culture do you think will help us endure climate change? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We Homo sapiens are fundamentally alike, and because we are all the same species, our reactions to unexpected events are often remarkably similar across time and space. So that right there is a key point coming from a pair of archaeologists who are helping tell the story of ancient climate change, and we're hearing about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a complex, harrowing story, surviving late ice age, extreme cold, crippling droughts, not to mention these emperors who relied on food from faraway lands. Have humans lost touch with nature and the traditional skills that helped our ancestors survive periods of climate change? 800-642-1234. Their new book is called Climate Chaos, and archaeologists Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan stay with us. Brian, we're headed to the Roman Empire now, which came about, I understand, in a pretty stable climate, a period of warm, generally wet environmental weather. What was the Roman Empire like?
It was an empire which was truly remarkable. It was glued together by overwhelming military force, by ruthless government, by centralized government, and also by a remarkable communication system, which, for example, as you know, the famous Roman roads and so on. But it being very diverse and enormous, it simply, in the long term, outgrew the scale and extent of a state in a world where there were, and particularly in Eastern Mediterranean, different states competing for political power. And it was, above all, a state where there were those who had and those who had not. And those who had, at the pinnacle, were deeply involved in constant plotting and political activity. And the gap between those who have and those who did not, the 1% and the West, grew ever larger. And on top of it, slavery became a major supporting institution of the state. And the result was that it became increasingly vulnerable.
Yeah, and you had this intensive monoculture and then importing grain from North Africa. What impact did that have?
That had an enormous impact. And it has been studied particularly in the context of the Nile. We think of ancient Egypt as a civilization nourished by the unfailing Nile floods. Every summer, the Nile would flood, and then the waters would recede, and people would plant their crops, which grew very well on the slowly drying out floodplain. This is to some degree true, and it's become a historical myth. In fact, the Nile was strongly influenced by monsoons and El Niños, and in fact was a very capricious river. And the result was that, for example, in 2100 BC, there was a century when the Nile's floods were very poor, which had devastating effects in Egypt. But later on, when you get a situation where an outside power, Rome, which basically took over Egypt 2,000 years ago, becomes dependent on a monoculture of wheat cultivation on the Nile. You can see that a state based in Roman Constantinople became utterly vulnerable to droughts in North Africa and on the Nile. And the importance of foreign grain rose and rose to the point that there was a highly organized trade in grain, which traveled in large galleys to Rome and Constantinople across the Mediterranean like clockwork. And in fact, there was a ceremony in the Eastern Roman Empire when the emperor in Constantinople would formally check the storehouses and reward the storehouse keepers very well if the grain was okay. If it wasn't, there was a problem. Why? Because an enormous quantity of the Rome's and Constantinople's urban populations depended on free handouts from the emperor, from the government. And if that handout failed or became less, there was, like clockwork, social disorder. Yeah. And if you run a 1% society, your biggest fear is social disorder.
If you're just joining us, we have archaeologists Brian Fagan and Nadia Durrani co-wrote Climate Chaos, exploring how ancient civilizations inform how we should understand the climate crisis today. Nadia, I'm just stuck on how you say that these cities like Rome were massive germ pools, just that they were overrun with infection and, like, you know, 100,000 pounds of human excrement daily. What was the impact of on health and on you know, with plagues and things like that?
Well, interestingly, the oldest so-called city in the world, which is a more like a big town called Çatalhöyük over in Turkey, that was excavated in the 20th century, and it's absolutely clear that even that oldest so-called city was a place full of infection, disease. You know, it really did impact people. When you start living cheek by jowl, that's where humans start spreading disease to one another. And obviously we've just experienced that and how difficult it is to overcome this sort of thing. And in the past, before there were any means to overcome such pandemics, so many people perished. And we see huge population declines as a result of these scourges. And they keep happening throughout time, throughout the time that humans have settled down, actually. I think the oldest example, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the oldest example of the plague that we know is the bubonic plague, I think it dates to something like 3000 BC or so, which is around the time that people started living very much closer together.
Yeah. Let's bring in Bill in Madison with a question. Bill, hi, go ahead.
Well, it's more of a comment. I wanted to point out that in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, there's a scene in which the queen of the fairies, who's quarreling with her husband, accuses him of interfering with the rituals that the fairies perform to maintain the order of nature, as a result of which, basically, the climate's failing. And I think the salient point here is that she sees that that is the responsibility, well, the fairies in that case, but the world depends on the rituals that are performed our understanding of that is can be interpreted in at least two ways. One, that there's a direct effect of, you know, this makes the sun come up or something. The other is that this underlies human behavior, mm-hmm. on which things like the climate do in fact depend. And we were thinking that probably reflects ancient wisdom.
Yeah, Bill, thank you. Brian, the rituals to the gods.
Ah, divine Rolf. This, believe it or not, in this day and age, every time there's a major disaster like a hurricane, somebody like clockwork, normally some preacher somewhere, talks about divine vengeance and wrath and sin. We know now that climate change was entirely a phenomenon of the environment. But divine attribution is very, very prevalent and has been prevalent for hundreds of years, simply because one of the things that was very common in ancient societies was seeking to explain the forces of nature and the cosmos. And there was a real fear of the supernatural, of the impersonal, seeming impersonal and violent forces, of, for the sake of argument, hurricanes, or of strong storms or whatever.
And we have to pause right there. Brian Fagan and Nadia Durrani, archaeologists. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're exploring a 30,000-year history of the relationship between climate and civilizations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's that tour at warp speed, courtesy of a pair of archaeologists. America, Rome, China, India, floods, volcanoes, droughts, balmy years, famine, war, exploitation, adaptation, cooperation. It's all in the new book called Climate Chaos. What lessons can we draw from this? Join in 800-642-1234. Archaeologists and co-authors Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan stay with us for the hour. We heard from John in Minocqua, called in, couldn't stay with us, Nadia. And John is wondering if the long history of climate crisis, of climate adaptations, is an indication that climate change is not the fault of humans, but rather it's just a natural cycle.
So this is something that is commonly confused, I think. And yes, natural climate change occurs and always has done. That's absolutely clear. What's different is in the post-industrial era, in the current era, since the time of the Industrial Revolution, so about 200 odd years ago, humans have driven the climate change. So the climate is getting warmer when naturally it should actually be getting a bit colder because of the tilt of the earth. So we are changing the climate in ways that will be devastating for us, because sometimes we think, oh, just a degree change, that doesn't really mean that much. Yes, actually it does. Okay, we're already experiencing some of the results of that. As your caller said, however, there always has been natural climate change. And that's a lot of what we're looking at in this book as well. What happens to human societies in the wake of natural climate change, much of it having been natural up to about 250 years ago, when, as I say, it's human driven. And your previous caller had a really, really good question as well about what happens when, you know, people blame other people, or equally, when people turn to their leaders or to gods to explain things. And one thing, you know, saying that the fairies did it or have you. So just so you know, we experienced what is known as the Little Ice Age from about 1300 to 1800. And interestingly, in that period, we see a lot of violent scapegoating of people. Hmm. So for example, the first systematic witch hunts occurred in the 1430s. And by the 1480s, women, witches, were being held accountable for the poor weather. So you see all these kind of horrible activities where different groups of people are being blamed, sometimes directly for the change in weather, sometimes indirectly, like the different Jewish groups were blamed for different problems that resulted from the climate change in the medieval period, for example. But likewise, you know, he drew on the sort of supernatural thing, and we mm-hmm. see that completely. And in so many different cultures, you know, for example, the Moche of northern Peru, they believed that their leaders were doing everything. Their ceremonies were making sure that the sun shone, that the weather was good. And of course, when things didn't work out, when it was clear that the leaders weren't actually these semi-divine people who were controlling the weather, then the culture starts to crumble and disappear.
Yeah, people so turning on each other. Yeah, and really the stress of that environment, not just from the natural world, but imposed upon each other, is also what I'm hearing would degrade those civilizations.
Mm, exactly.
Yeah. Let's go to Kenneth now in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. I just like to preface my remarks in that I think your book is contributing to the confusion regarding because you're talking about two entirely different things in people reacting to the environment and man-made caused environmental change. And what we have now is man-made environmental change, and we can do something about it. And my question is, Damascus has always been considered the oldest city in the world, and you stated that a city in Turkey, if you could spell that city, please, and where it's located.
Kenneth, thank you. Brian, you go first there.
Actually, it's more a town or a very large village. Catalhoyuk, C-A-T-A-L, one word, second word, H-O-Y-U-K. Catalhoyuk is in central Turkey. It has been brilliantly excavated with very fine-grained research by an international team of archaeologists who have conjured up and developed this extraordinarily detailed picture of a city which prospered for thousands of years and ran into big trouble due to congestion and, as Nadia pointed out, social disorder and so on. And there is no doubt at all that this was very much a product of, firstly, more pervasive dry conditions, which caused them to move away from cattle herding, and also from just the number of people there living at close juxtaposition. Just close juxtaposition is extremely fertile ground for infections of all kinds. And one of the things that was going on here is that you lost the ability to move away. When you're a small hunter living, for example, in the middle of what was now the North Sea, which was dry land, and the sea levels rise, it's easy. You just move. There may be 30 people in your band, and the population is not huge. But if you're stuck in Catalhoyuk, or in Damascus, or in other cities like the Indus, your ability to disperse, unless you have very close connections with the villages around you, is much reduced. I mean, look at the problems they have evacuating New Orleans mm-hmm. when there was Hurricane Katrina. It's traffic, it's crowds, it's everything. So there are a lot of things going on of which nature is one.
Nadia, you bring up the Mocha and in the pre-Inca culture, and they were apparently really well aware of the effects of powerful El Niños. What role did El Niños play in climate change?
Well, they played an enormous role in natural climate change. The previous caller is absolutely correct that there is natural climate change that happens all the time, and there's human-caused climate change. And I think lots of people are confused about that. And I think that we spell it out very carefully in the book, that we're not confusing the two, but what we're looking at is how humans dealt with naturally occurring climate change and what lessons we might take from that in the climate change issues that we are now causing, because obviously the whole point is we need to react, we need to get together, we need forward planning, we need to look to the past to understand what happened, and we can't sit on our high horses, or we can't sit there and think, oh, it's absolutely fine, we've been through it before, we'll get through it again. Actually, no, in the past people didn't always get through it, and I think that's one thing climate change deniers often pick up on, that we've done it before, we'll do it again. No, We didn't. People suffered horrifically in the past, and we don't always hear about that. For example, you'll think about the sort of medieval warm period, about how lovely it was and how great things were. But actually, what you're doing is you're not seeing the nuances. You're not seeing what happened during the Ice Age snap that we experienced as well. So there are all these sort of difficult problems that we overcame, or equally we didn't overcome, and that's what we are looking at in the book. So we're looking back at how to respond to climate issues through the great depth of time that we can now look back at.
We're talking with Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan. They're archaeologists, co-writers of Climate Chaos, exploring how these ancient civilizations inform how we should understand the climate crisis today, and fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. In the Pueblo world, there was harmony, you said, an order, some really basic values that really helped with flexibility and with movement and working together to kind of assess risk management. And you made me think about risk management in a whole new way. Nadia, Brian, how would you look at that Chaco history?
What you're dealing with, and this is an important book issue right through the book, you're looking at kin ties. Yes, we have relatives, we have family, we have extended family, but kin ties are not nearly as important in our urban society as they used to be. We live in a much more anonymous society. Pueblo society, ancient Pueblo society, functioned off an engine, and the engine was kin ties, maintained over many generations, not within one small village, but over surprisingly long distances. Because one of the ways in which the ancient Pueblo, the ancestral Pueblo, as they call themselves, adapted to drought or other issues to do with climate was through mobility, or also by another institution, which is called reciprocity, which is where if you had kin in a village, say 30 miles away, who hadn't got the rain that you got, and it literally can vary within 5 miles, in environments which are extremely challenging to cultivate in, it, with your kin ties, the central thing was that you provided food, you provided grain, you helped them, and you helped each other, knowing that each side would help each other over the generations. Because the other point which you must make very strikingly about Pueblo Indian society, and as true today as it was in the past, is that generational memory, institutional memory, is absolutely vital. Because although today there is literacy, back in ancient times, all information was passed from one generation to the next by word of mouth. Mm-hmm. This could be through chant, through ceremony, through ritual. All of these were vital ways of providing information from one generation to the next. The experience of elders, of people who've been around for a while. And remember, if you were 35, you were an elder, because life expectancy was in your 20s. And can you imagine the influence of someone who'd lived for 70 years? You get this passing of institutional memory. And with things like that, kinship is vitally important, because kin are people you can trust. And a lot of trade worked on the basis of contacts with individuals who were fellow kin, or even people you didn't even meet personally, who you trusted.
Well, it makes me wonder, Nadia, when did like fluent speech and language really develop and evolve and make such an impact on how you would respond to the climate?
That is a fascinating question. Now you're going back millions of years. We find the gene for language and speech in Homo sapiens and also in Neanderthals. So we obviously know that from the start, from at least 400,000 years ago, we had speech and language. But going back before then, we can only sort of make guesses. And there's a really interesting project at Cambridge University looking at stone tools and seeing whether there's some sort of almost like vocabulary in the stone tools. Given that you've got a sort of early hominin called Homo erectus, you know, the upright human, he's at about, or he or she, they're at about 1.9 million years ago. Skeletally, they're quite similar to us. So why not? We might imagine they had big brains, perhaps they had speech and language, perhaps they were already communicating in speech and language, perhaps it wasn't quite as fluent as our own. You know, we don't get art in the way that we see human art until about, we start getting the first signs of modern art about 80,000 years ago in a cave in Africa. We get these beautiful little beads and so on. Something happens with Homo sapiens sapiens, you and me, right? Something happens where our communication skills possibly are better than any other hominin before us. So we're definitely chatting about the weather since Homo sapiens tread the earth. But so I think we were all talking about it. And when we Homo sapiens, when some of us left our African homeland and we came to, let's say, Europe, and it was suddenly really, really cold, you can guarantee that we're talking about the weather, and we're making good quality clothes for ourselves. We're using needles. We're using really kind of lovely advanced Homo sapien tools to look after ourselves. And funnily enough, we are the only hominin left on Earth. There used to, before about maybe 30 or 40,000 years ago, there were several different species of hominin, hominin being something in the human family tree. There were several of us still around. There was us, the Neanderthals, another set in Siberia. But now it's just us. So we were definitely having a chit-chat around the campfire about all sorts of things.
Archaeologists Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan giving us a fuller picture of how our ancestors adapted to climate shifts and how they nurtured community ties, as we've been talking about, kinship, solve problems locally to make it. Are there local solutions to the climate crisis being worked on in your community? How is your family adapting? What lessons did your ancestors pass down to you about living off the land? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute. Talk more here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring this central question. How could the societies of the past adapt and survive abrupt climate changes? It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our ancestors, they needed more than masterful flood walls and these canals and control of trade routes. They needed kinship, right? They needed each other in unity and cooperation to respond to the risks of climate and source local solutions. What rings true today? 800-642-1234. The book is Climate Chaos, and co-authors, archaeologists Nadia Durrani and Brian Fagan. Stay with us for about seven more minutes. Let's fast forward, Brian, and you write about, I can't even believe like 1600s is super, super recent, but, you know, Native American societies, they're adapting to really prolonged droughts in North America. And you find that signs in the Southwest give us hints about how a future is being transformed by anthropogenic global warming. What is being revealed?
I think one of the big lessons we've learned for the future is that a great deal of action to adapt to climate change doesn't involve enormous grandiose government schemes and prancing by politicians. What we find is a great deal of adaptation is local. Federal and state governments may help, but local issues like adapting to higher sea levels and so on require both action and funding at a local level. And I think one of the most striking things about this to me is the importance of local communities, small communities, looking after their own interests. We are all interdependent, but I think local adaptation, local initiatives are very, very important.
Nadia, how about you? I mean, what do you see going on in North America and the Southwest in those times?
Well, like Brian says, there was a lot of dependence on one another. And sometimes we are very not thinking about one another in the modern world. And I think one of the lessons we picked up when we were doing all our research was really that thing about, come on, we're in this together, and we can each make a change. And, you know, that's the sort of greater thing, isn't it? Where we can all do our bit, and we can all get together just as they did in North America, in order to try and help mitigate some of the issues.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if we've kind of lost touch with, you know, with how local decisions happen and how flexible governments have to be, and how, you know, really trying to source food from halfway around the world, you know, is a huge risk. What are those lessons that you see as you study these civilizations?
I think one of the things we've realized is just how startlingly vulnerable we are to large major climatic shifts. And the classic example of this, of course, is drought. Mm. And it's very interesting. I once attended a lecture by a very senior official from Bangladesh, much of which is 38 feet above sea level or less. And this gentleman, who dealt with climatic change and security, said that in 50 years, that's not a long time by our standards, something like 50 million people may have to move. But where are they going to go? India doesn't want them. Myanmar doesn't want them. Nobody wants them. And one of the big solutions or strategies to deal with things like drought has always been to move. And a great deal of the migration you see today is ultimately, indirectly or directly, connected with environmental change, with drier conditions in already poor countries. And one of the most striking things is that there are virtually no international policies to deal with this crisis, which has barely begun. Mm. I mean, this is nothing compared with what may be the case in 50 years. So it's a very sobering scenario, and we can't ignore it.
Nadia, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think Brian's absolutely right. We can't ignore these issues. And what we did realize looking back over all the years is the need for forward thinking leadership, that being one of the ways that we can help solve the problems.
Well, Nadia and Brian, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
The book is called Climate Chaos: Lessons on Survival from Our Ancestors. Co-author Brian Fagan is Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at UC Santa Barbara. Co-author Nadia Durrani is an archaeologist and editor and founder of Past Worlds magazine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This conversation comes to you on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.